Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Health and Social Services Committee to order. The time is 1:34 p.m., 19th of February, 2014. With me today is Senator Ellis, Senator Kelly, Senator Meyer, Senator Machicki, and myself, Senator Stedman. Today, we're going to have two bills on the agenda, Senate Bill 161 and Senate Bill 151. Both of these bills are sponsored by Senator Olson. And the Senate Bill 1, we'll start off with Senate Bill 161 regarding autopsies and death certificates, again sponsored by Senator Olson. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. We have been joined today with staff from Senator Olson's office. If he could introduce himself for the record, who he represents, and take the committee through the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm David Scott, staff to Senator Olson. Senator Olson thanks you for hearing the bill, and he's in another committee. He can't be here, but he sends his regards. The bill in front of us, 161, is that what we're doing?
Yep.
Sorry. 161 deals with, obviously, you could look at the title, with the medical examiner and autopsies. The bill was introduced to try to alleviate some unforeseen and in no way were they intentional, but there have been some situations where families in rural Alaska have had very difficult times when their deceased family members had to go to Anchorage for an autopsy, and how the body is returned, and how the medical examiner and the form that is used was it could be construed that the form was trying to push the family members to release the remains to a funeral home, which costs quite a bit of money. So we were approached to look into this, and we have the bill in front of you, which we also added a couple sections to try to use that every single death that requires an autopsy doesn't necessarily have to be flown to Anchorage, and we tried to institute some, I guess, for lack of a better term, telemedicine options in here to try to save the state money. The state currently spends general fund dollars to transport remains from communities to Anchorage for an autopsy and use the general fund dollars to send them back. And so it's a proposal in the bill, and we're willing to work with the medical examiners on it, but we think that in the long run it might be able to save the state money. Turning to the bill itself, in section one, we really add we go from a may to a shall on line 13, and you'll see that with it has to deal with the transportation of the body. And there's also on page 2, line 3, still in section 1, there's a language there that the sponsor is willing to remove, but he thinks it should be a part of a discussion here. We understand that it says that to buy a policy of a transporting entity, that means that an airline could require embalming, and we don't think that the policy of a private company should affect what the state does. But the sponsor is willing to negotiate and talk on that. Section 2 adds two subsections dealing with the medical examiner and trying to institute with the advent of technology that, like I already said, that we don't have, so every autopsy doesn't have to be conducted in Anchorage, that we could do it via basically video over the internet. Section 2G is also a new section of law, which you will see on that a person who is responsible for the body and will get a form from the medical examiner's office, and we try to get the form. We're trying to put it into law where that what's going to be on that form. Then the medical examiner could also speak to this. Section 3 conforms to Section 4, and Section 4 is that a requires that a person designated, if there's no funeral director or in a smaller rural village, that a person could be designated by the state registrar to and they shall do it. They shall file the death certificate, and they shall obtain personal data from the next of kin and our best qualified person in that community. And this has to do with vital statistics as well, Mr. Chairman. And Section 5 is conforming to Section 6, and Section 6 requires that the medical examiner shall obtain a burial transmit permit before the body is transported. That's the bill in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman. There is a fiscal note that comes from Hess. There's also we put on the members in the members' packets. There's a draft new form from the state medical examiner's office, and you'll notice that they've been in discussions with them. They've been great discussions, and they see the issue, and they've tried to already come up with a form for this. And you'll notice that the first line of the form says, and I'm reading, there's no legal requirement for the use of a funeral home. And we hope that this is the beginning of a discussion to try to alleviate families suffering during tough times. And that's why the bill was introduced, and it's the intent of the sponsor. And I'm available for any questions.
Do committee members have any initial questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, seeing none, we're going to move on then. Let me just mention that there's a fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services in the amount of $115,000 in general funds to implement these changes. We're going to go ahead and go now to the public testimony portion. We'll start with the online. We have three people signed up initially. If you can identify yourself for the record, who you represent, please, and then speak to Senate Bill 161. Rebelli Whitcomb from Dillingham.
Hi, yes, this is Rebelli Whitcomb. Thank you. I am wearing two hats today. I'm the director of the Workforce Development Center at BBNA in Dillingham, and I'm also testifying on behalf of my family on Senate Bill 161. First off, the legal requirement for use of the medical examiner, it on BBNA's standpoint, it has created some circumstances where we've had additional burdens that come on the families directly within our region. We provide burial assistance alongside with the state. Many times we've had to deal with the transportation issues, the cost of that, the cost of embalming, dealing with air transportation between the different vendors. Who can carry it, what has to be carried in. All of those things are a significant burden on the behalf of the family. The next part of it gets into areas where, of course, there's limited funding. So the impact is directly upon the organization that might help. It might be the state. It might be the tribal organization. And the need for that sometimes goes against family requests or religious concerns. Embalming is not a typical use by customary and traditional villagers, certainly not, not within religions such as the Catholic and certain most definitely Orthodox, which I am. And the need for that to be done prior to transportation. It's one thing to have a traumatic death and have to go through the medical examiner's office to get an answer to how a person had passed away. But it's another whole scenario when you start dealing with the cost and getting that individual back home. Now I'd like to testify on behalf of myself. Unfortunately, I've lost a few people in my life. One of them was my brother, who had a traumatic gunshot wound to the head. We were enforced to pay for embalming costs, which was not necessarily according to the medical examiner's office, but yet we had to deal with a funeral home in Anchorage. Unfortunately, funeral homes are profit-making businesses, They charge per hour. They charge per service. By the time we had my brother's remained placed back into Dillingham, it was a significant burden on my brother's children and his family, not including the rest of us. The need to transport an individual back and forth is also not currently, I mean, including within the state of Alaska, it's also outside. Another portion of my family address is transporting out of state, you know, and the time differences, and we understand the need for embalming with that. But every time that you transport somebody, there's an extra charge with that. So the state sends the body into Anchorage to get embalmed, I mean, to go to the medical examiners. Transportation wants us to pay for embalming, and that's not a cheap price. It's typically $900 to $1,000. Then they make us pay for a container to carry them in, which is typically somewhere between $2,000 and $6,000, really depending on what the family can afford. Then you have the requirements to have a container, I mean a wrapped unit that goes around the container, and that's typically another $500. So now we have the ME's office that will pay the cost of the weight of the individual that went into Anchorage in what we call the nice little silver bullets. They're little silver metal containers, but yet we can't use those to send those remains back to our communities. That's not allowed. So we pay some additional burdens there. This bill does impact us out in the rural areas, and it does impact families. Once a person is brought into a funeral home, the time delays on getting that person goes significantly higher, and then we face funerals that don't release bodies until the bill is paid in full. We've had circumstances where we've had remains, you know, 2 to 3 weeks out to getting returned back to their community. So this bill is important. Please hear our concerns. The dispute between, you know, who's paying what costs, we understand that the state will pick this up many times. It's either between the ME's office or Department of Health and Human Services. I do want to take some time and thank you for hearing this bill. It is a concern.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony today. Next up, Jackie Russell from Bristol Bay Area Health Corp.
Hi, I'm the social worker at BBAHC, Connecticut Hospital, and I'm sort of new, but I can testify is very important bill. I'd like to say I am for SB 161 because it's important to the families that we serve in a positive way. It would affect or impact the families. I think that Ray Bell Whitcomb really gave a nice round summary of how it does affect our families in her own personal way. I appreciated that. Families come to the Connecticut Hospital to receive an end-of-life care, and when death occurs, because most of the times families can't afford it, they call BBNA for burial benefits and their village tribal councils to help them pay for the casket, the travel, and any other added costs that Ray Bell mentioned. BBAHC has some communicative services, telecommunication services, and we're all the time working on upgrading that. Progress in telemedicine, I'm sorry, couldn't speak, that we're working on, and we have a wonderful lab and imaging capabilities that we could cooperate with the medical examiner as a team be able to make this process a lot easier and a lot less expensive for the families. So I just wanted to say that I hope you pass this bill because it would deeply impact our families that we serve. Thank you very much for hearing me.
Jackie, could you identify yourself for the record, please, and who you represent?
Oh, yes. I'm Jackie Russell, the social worker at Connecticut Hospital and BBAHC.
Okay. And that's Bristol Bay Native or Bristol Bay Health Corporation? Is that correct?
Area Health Corporation.
Okay. Thank you, Jackie. Next up, Carrie Shelton from Anchorage. If she can identify herself, who she represents, and speak to the bill, please.
Thank you. This is Carrie Shelton for the record. I'm the director for the Alaska Division of Public Health. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as with the last two speakers, I do want to thank you for this opportunity to testify on this bill. This is very important to us, and you know, the care of the families in the state of Alaska is very critical to the division and to the medical examiner's office. I just wanted to go over a few things with you today. Our state medical examiner's office, as you all may or may not be aware, they exist here in the state, and there's only one office and located here in Anchorage. They exist to determine cause and manner of death for cases that are brought under the jurisdiction of the state medical examiner's office. Now, that does not include all deaths within the state. Typically, there are between 1,600 and 1,700 deaths annually within Alaska. Only about half of those traditionally are brought within the jurisdiction of the state medical examiner's office, and the criteria for that is set out in current statute. Those would be the homicides, suicides, the accidental deaths, suspicious, unattended, those types of cases. The expected home deaths or expected hospital deaths, those are not brought within the jurisdiction of the medical examiner's office. So it's just those that we need to examine that are brought to Anchorage. And what happens here in Anchorage is when the cases are brought in, there are autopsies performed, but that doesn't always mean that it's an internal examination. Sometimes it's just an external exam, but it's really based on the individual circumstances of the case. So in some cases, there needs to be internal work, and other cases, it's just an external exam. But all cases have certain testing that go through. We do toxicology testing. We do x-rays on the cases and certain other things to make sure we fully determine that the cause and manner of death. Our staff at the medical examiner's office, we have three forensic pathologists. One position is currently vacant, so we just have the two on staff right now, but we're in recruitment for that third position. And then we also have autopsy technicians and investigators. So that small staff of about 17 currently, that staff deals with the caseload for the entire state. And we saw last year 857 cases brought into the medical examiner's office. There's another 775 cases last year that were not brought into the medical examiner's office. So since we're located here in Anchorage, we really rely on local law enforcement outside of the drivable area in the Anchorage area. And those local law enforcement folks are the ones who actually go on scene. They are our eyes and ears, if you will. They're the ones that collect the scene information for us and work with our investigators who also talk with the family members, talk with other witnesses around, and they collect all of that investigatory information. They consult with our medical examiner pathologists and determine if the case meets the criteria for being brought into the jurisdiction and into the Anchorage facility. So once that determination is made, then we go about the process of transporting the body into Anchorage. As soon as it is in, we get the autopsy scheduled, necessary tests, and we try to process those as quickly as possible so that they can be returned back to the family in as timely a manner as possible. There are some cases that take longer than others just based on the circumstances of death that they're brought into. But we do recognize that the sensitivity and the emotional nature of these, and you know, the cases that the medical examiner's office sees are ones that are really, you know, that the family wasn't expecting it. These are the unexpected deaths. These are the ones that were not anticipated. So there is already, we fully understand a level of trauma and emotion that goes along with this, and we try to minimize that to the extent possible. We do have several policies in place within the medical examiner's office that we have used to try to help the families, even though it's not statutory requirements. Things like we will transport the body back to a location other than the location nearest death if it's not an additional cost to us. If it is an additional cost, the family pays the difference in that cost. But we will do that for them, and we've done that many times. We do provide the burial transit permit when the bodies leave the office. So that's something that if the body's not picked up by a funeral home, Whoever comes in to pick up the body on behalf of the next of kin, we provide that transit permit for them. So that's not a charge. It's not a wait. It's just provided to them when they pick up the body. We have frequently asked questions on our website that we have just recently revised based on conversations with Representative Heron in his office, and are always happy to try to make those clearer, more understandable for everyone involved. And as Senator Olson's staffer explained, we did also just revise our authorization of release of remains form to make that clear that we're not trying to push families toward a funeral home by any stretch of the imagination. We want what's best for the family, and if they don't want to use a funeral home, that's fine with us. We have absolutely no stake in that. So we tried to make that clear and really list what their options are. We do not any longer do embalming in the state medical examiner's office. There was a law that required embalming post-forensic exam, but that law was abolished as of 2005. So we do not do embalming any longer, and we have never had an instance where an airline has required that of us when we've tried to ship a body back. Funeral homes do embalming, and if embalming is necessary, that would be a contracted service to a funeral home. As well as the cosmetology, if there's any disfigurement because of a post-mortem examination, that would be contracted out to a funeral home as well. We do not have the abilities to do that work. And there's a mention of temperature controls within the bill. In certain circumstances, if a body is badly decomposed, we will freeze it prior to shipment to try to reduce any extraneous odors or what have you. But there's no way for us to maintain that body temperature or those conditions once it's on the aircraft or in the airline facilities. And as far as the rural exams go, we don't know of any facility that has appropriate infrastructure to perform a medical legal death investigation, forensic examination. Outside of the Fairbanks facility, there is an autopsy room available in the Fairbanks facility, but they do not have any telemedicine equipment, nor does the state medical examiner's office. We don't have any telemedicine equipment either. And really, we have found throughout the years that there's just not a caseload that supports us maintaining a full autopsy capability outside the Anchorage area. There just isn't that many in the entire state to warrant more than one office that we found. But there would be a substantial amount of equipment, even if just external exams were done remotely. There's a substantial amount of equipment that would be required to make sure that it is legally defensible, that it's medically appropriate, that it really meets the standards that all bodies should be held to when we're caring for them. As well as our forensic pathologists, of course, we have ours here on staff, but there aren't trained board-certified forensic pathologists out in the rural communities. And again, you know, these cases and the work that we do, it must be legally defensible, and we must provide the same standard of care for all of our families, for all of our cases. And there shouldn't be a disparity based on any geographic location for that. One of the things that we're not sure about with this bill is the liability in terms of if an exam was done by someone other than our pathologist, who would be responsible for signing the death certificate, who would be responsible for testifying in court on the case, who would accept the responsibility for the condition of the body after the examination. So there are some things legally that would certainly have to be worked out as well. So with that, just wanted to close out my comments and say that I am available for questions.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Okay. That concludes our off-net and LIO offices. We'll come to the public hearing. I'll bring it in the room. We have one person signed up, Marcia Davis. She can come up. She's been here, this committee, this room, different subjects.
Yes.
So you know the drill.
Thank you, Chairman Stedman. My name is Marcia Davis, and I'm General Counsel, Senior Vice President for Telista Corporation. and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 161. We have a nonprofit organization, Chelista Heritage Foundation, which is responsible primarily for scholarships, educational opportunities for our shareholders and descendants, but we also have burial assistance. And in that capacity, we have been privy to many of the bills that have been submitted for payment, looking for funds to help families cover these costs. And when I delved into it, because I was seeing all the nonprofits in the region getting tapped out, these were large sums of money, $2,000, $3,000, $6,000, $7,000 a pop. And I was trying to figure out why this was happening. And so as I dug into it, I found out it had been a problem that had been happening for over 10, 15 years, and that there had been efforts made in the region to correct it, to try to get it under control, but they had not been met with much success in terms of dealing with the state agencies involved. So I thought, well, surely we can solve this. So I looked at it, studied the laws, went over, and I actually called Department of Health and Social Services, was directed to their legislative person, had one very thorough conversation with him, was promised fallback, and after three unreturned phone calls, I gave up. And so then I thought, well, gosh, the Emmy's office is right around the corner from my house on the way to work. I'm going to stop in. And it's kind of a lockdown facility like the state troopers are, because it's a law enforcement type of agency. And I tapped on the bulletproof glass and asked if I could speak to the administrative assistant, because I figured if I just started with someone who was the public face, you know, that knew the details, I'd find out what was going on. So I posed the question. I said, look, we have a Heritage Foundation. I'm just trying to figure out what are the real bills and what are not real bills, so we know whether we're reimbursing things that we should be reimbursing. And she very kindly stepped out behind the glass, sat down with me, and I was able to run through all the issues that I'd heard expressed from our region, from our shareholders. And what I learned, ultimately, you know, I think that office is doing what they think is a very good job, and they're reaching out to people. But as I ask questions about cultural sensitivity, I ask questions, for instance, when they end up with a body and it comes from the region and they need to find a next of kin or anything, I said, well, how do you find a next of kin? Well, we'll talk to the trooper or somebody. I said, don't you have a list of the village administrators, you know, the contacts for every village in rural Alaska? No. Well, wouldn't that be helpful? Well, I suppose so. I kind of started getting a feeling that there really hadn't been a lot of communication between the Emmy's office and rural Alaska at all. And when I looked at the form that had been given, had been being given to these families, the very first thing they're hit with from the Emmy's office is this authorization to release remains form. So I thought, okay, well, let's put myself in the shoes of someone from Kwithluk or, you know, Akiachak or something and say, okay, authorization for release. I've just suffered a traumatic loss. It's a suicide. It's an accidental death. And the first thing I see is I'm being asked to give them a mortuary name. Okay. And then it says, if I don't select a mortuary, then give me the name of the person who's going to pick up the remains. Well, I'm out in Bush, Alaska. I can't pick up the remains. They're in Anchorage now. I mean, every time I stepped through this form, it puzzled me. And I can read English really well, and there's folks out in the region who can't. And then I hit the sentence, the SMEO strongly recommends the use of a funeral home at the family's expense for proper disposition of the body. We do not prepare and embalm individuals, and we assume no liability for the condition of the body. I'm frightened now. I'm thinking, gosh, I don't know what I'm going to be getting now, and they're recommending I do this, and I better sign it. And so I go, you know, if I go to the second page with all these lots of little words, then I find out that, again, they're recommending I use a funeral home, and then they tell me I've got to get a burial transit permit. They'll provide the form, but how do I do that? Where do I do that? What is a burial transit permit? Now I'm really in a quandary, but a funeral home will do that for me. Oh, gosh, I guess. And then they also say they don't provide any embalming, dressing, casketing, or cosmetizing of the remains. Boy, this is going to be ugly. And how does the body get shipped? It's shipped in a container constructed of plywood with a corrugated cardboard top. Maybe I should bring some duct tape, just in case. You know, I mean, this form scares people. And it would scare me. So, and then nowhere on here does it tell me what the costs are. if I do sign on for a funeral home and I'm from the village, well, gosh, 500, I know what we do in the village, you know. The person dies in the hospital bed. The family comes in, usually same gender, and they'll wash the body down. And they'll take it. Either they'll take it from the hospital bed or they'll take it from the morgue, and they bring it home. And they put it in the home for 3 days, visitation, where people come, bring food, talk, share love, share stories. And after 3 days, the body is buried in a simple box that somebody makes out in the bush, and it's buried. And that's it. And so that experience is so far removed from this. So, gosh, you know, trauma, suicide, accidental death, I've got the scary form. I better sign it because I can't pick it up. And now it goes to a funeral home. I'll deal with it then. And when I talk to the Native families that have been through their process, I said, well, didn't you stop and ask questions? Didn't you wonder what your other choices were? Well, no, you just go with the flow. You just go with the flow because you don't know what else to do at that point. So they find out later that the funeral costs. The funeral homes charge $500 to pick up the body from the ME's office to take it to the funeral home. Then they embalm, they do the casket, they then charge another $500 or so to take it from the funeral home to the airport. Then there's these special body trays that airlines require. And all that they see from the ME's office from that point forward is a little credit that will be, as I think someone spoke before, freight weight. If 130 pounds and the silver bullet comes in, they will give a credit to the funeral home against the charge of 130-pound freight weight to go back. And that's all they'll see. And as far as where it goes, you know, when I asked the gal at the ME's office, where will you ship it? Well, the statute only allows us to ship it to the place of death. But if the family is, let's say the place of death was in Accuchak, but the body's going to be buried in Queethluck, which means Bethel is a common spot, they'll stop it in Bethel, and then the family will come across and try to figure out how to get the body from Bethel because they don't want it in Accuchak. And it's unclear to me how often they actually got reimbursed for the cost to get it to the other place, if it was cheaper or not. Families can't cope with that. So definitely the form needed to be revised, and then definitely the cost to ship the body back needed to be done. And then when you look at the form, the statute says they are to perform cosmetology, but the form says they don't. So the form is different than what the law requires. I get a little excited about it because I've just seen so much cost put onto the backs of these families out there who can't afford their subsistence lifestyle. They don't have spare cash. And then we've heard stories of families, the bodies were held hostage. And then ultimately, if they could get the body back, it would be because somebody stepped up and signed a promissory note. Or they raided the coffers of all the nonprofits and the churches and everybody who stepped forward and paid the money. I have actually, when I was researching other state laws on this matter, I actually found a law, and I think it was in North Dakota, where it's a crime to withhold a body for money. You know, I mean, it just, it makes me wonder about, you know, what's going on here. And I don't think the ME's office is trying to be mean. They're not trying to be insensitive. It's just they've got a tough job to do. They've got, in their fiscal note, they note 400 bodies get transported to them a year. And that's a lot of bodies to process through there. And things can stack up, and I imagine life is a lot easier for them if people shift the body to a funeral home. And in their worldview, well, wouldn't anybody want to have the body be embalmed? Isn't that a first step for everybody? No, the answer is no, it's not. Not in Bush, Alaska, it's not. And for religious reasons, it's not. So this form that basically coerced folks off toward the funeral home really thwarted what naturally should happen in the region. And people ended up with bills they shouldn't have had to pay. And so what we've done with this bill is essentially try to do some of the things that the ME's office was doing, as you heard from Carrie a minute ago. They do some things that aren't required by statute, but they're nervous about that. That's the expression I got when I met with the ME's office. It's almost whispered, well, we'll do it, but it's not really allowed by law. We want to give the ME's cloaking of statutory authority to do some of these things, which they feel honor-bound to do anyway. So that's part of what this bill does. The other part that this does is ensure that that form discloses and ensures that it's a good form, because it hasn't been changed for a long time, and it took this to get some modification to the form. To be honest, I want to work with the department. I still don't like the way the form reads as it's been revised, but I'm sure that they'll work with us on that. What we want to do as a next step is translate it into UPIC once the form is in good shape, and we will be very aggressive out there in the social agencies to ensure that people's rights are known and that they don't, quote, just go with the flow because economically that suits the interests in the urban areas. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Marcia. We have anybody else that signed up? Okay. So that concludes the testimony in the room here. We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for further review. Next up, Senate Bill 151 regarding the high-risk chemicals of child exposure by Senator Olson, the bill sponsor. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and set the bill aside for further review. With us today is staff from Senator Olson's office. If he can introduce himself for the record, who he represents, and walk us through the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm David Scott, staff to Senator Olson. Senate Bill 151 in front of you. It's I guess it could be colloquially named as the Children's Safe Product Act, although there's no language that in the bill. the bill would prohibit and ban products containing certain flame retardants known as chlorinated tries. It would also require the Department of Environmental Conservation to participate and be a member of the, it's called the Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse. I'll talk about it in a little bit. Also, it requires the department to publish a list of chemicals of high concern for children and also periodically update that list, and whether you're adding to it or taking it away to that list. Also, some states are starting towards banning certain not only chlorinated tries, what it's colloquially named as, like New York did it in 2012, and Vermont has also done it, and the state of Washington has too. There's a national effort for to update the law passed in 1976, which was called the Toxic Substance Control Act. There's a current bill, and it's a Senate bill. It's called the Chemical Safety Improvement Act, which would update the Toxic Substance Control Act. So it's been 38 years since it's been looked at. The bill itself, to move to the bill, the mechanics of the bill, Mr. Chairman, it's pretty simple. I kind of highlighted it already, but if you look on, well, there's one section with has multiple sections in it. The first one, starting on page 1, line 8, that section requires to publish a list of chemicals of high concern to children. The second section on page 1, line 12, requires that before placing a chemical on that list, the department has to determine that the chemicals are of high concern. And then on the next page, we go into how they determine. And we say that the department shall find that the chemical has been identified by another government entity based on credible evidence. We put that in there so that there's no, you don't have to reinvent the wheel every time we're looking. If good science has been done in other governments, then we should accept it. To also in that section on page 2, really starting on line 8, we see how a chemical is of high potential concern for a child, that the science used in section B above there is they must do some biomonitoring to demonstrate presence of chemicals in human breast milk, urine, other bodily tissues, and also that sampling must be done in household dust, indoor air. So it really defined on how the science is used to make sure that a chemical is determined to be put on the list. Section, I guess would be page 2, line 17, is where the list could be reviewed, periodically reviewed and revised. And section 20, well, sorry, page 2, line 20 is where the prohibition. That is the prohibition of the tries. Section, I guess, page 2, line 29 is the penalties. And that's all the way through page 3, line 8. And then starting on page 3, line 8 is requiring the department to be a member of the Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse. The Interstate Chemicals Clearinghouse is an actual, I guess it's a clearinghouse of hard science, of studies that are commissioned by other governments in the United States. And you'll notice that in the title, it's not, they're not capitalized. So I need to ask the drafter on that, on if we should capitalize it, because I think it's a proper noun. But that's semantics. On page 3, line 17, it allows the department to adopt regs. Page 3, 19, line 19 is the definitions. And then we get to section 2 of the bill. Section 2 is it adds that violating 1831-640, which is the prohibition that I talked about, which is on page 2, would be a would be an unfair trade act. Section 3 is some transition language that by January 1st, 2016, the department will have their publish their list, the first list. Section 4 is revisor's instructions, and section 5 is the effective date. There are two fiscal notes, one from Hess and one from DEC. So also there's all kinds of literature I could, and studies and stuff I could forward to the committee, and I could really inundate you with it. I found one good one was it's in your books. It's green. It's called What's on Your List, and this is from Washington State. And also there's letters of support and letters of opposition. I should point that out. The fire chiefs are for it. Alaska fire chiefs are for it. Alaska nurses are in support. American Sustainable Business Council, never heard of them, but they're in support. Against is the State Chamber and the, I think it's called the American Chemicals, something, American Chemistry Council. And the council, the American Chemistry Council and the State Chamber are kind of in favor of what the Senate bill I mentioned earlier that would reform the 1976 Act. The sponsor is aware of that. However, he doesn't have the greatest faith in Congress that Congress is going to take it up and pass it. So he decided to introduce the bill and put it forward and see if this body and the other body will let it become law. With that, I can answer any questions.
Right. Do we have any initial questions for the bill sponsor? Okay, seeing none. We have two fiscal notes, as mentioned in your packet. One fiscal note from the Department of Health and Social Services in the amount of $37,000 in general funds to develop an inventory of chemicals of high concern in children's products. The second fiscal note from the Department of Environmental Conservation for $370,000 in general funds for two new environmental program specialist positions. We have several people signed up online. We're going to go into the public testimony portion. What I'm going to ask people to do, we've got about a little less than 45 minutes left. I'd like you to keep your comments to 2 minutes or less, or we're not going to be able to get through the list that everybody signed up for, and it'd be nice to accomplish that, and that'll pretty much run us right out of time. So with that, I'd like you, when you start, to introduce yourself for the record, your name, who you represent, and then speak to the bill, please. And if it's redundant testimony, you can always state that you support already entered testimony and brief it up a little bit, too, which would give other folks a little more time. With that, I'd like to go ahead and start with the Anchorage LIO. Jessica Walsh, please.
Hello. Can the committee hear me?
Yes. If you can identify yourself, please, for the record.
My name is Jessica Walsh, and I am a bachelor's RN. I'm working in women's health and maternity care. I'm also a student nurse, midwife, and a mother. I am speaking up to urge you to vote in favor of the Toxic Free Children's Act, SB 151. My work as a nurse caring for women in their reproductive years, I do a lot of counseling on the avoidance of harmful chemicals and toxins that are known endocrine disruptors in order for women to protect themselves for their future pregnancies. Part of the work I do with women in maternity care is educating them on how to avoid these toxins and chemicals in order to protect their baby from exposure in utero to chemicals that could alter their health or their genetic makeup. Despite that, when babies are born in Alaska or children are put to bed, placed on mats, or playing on furniture, they're being exposed to incredibly high amounts of noxious, carcinogenic materials that are known causes of serious health issues. The chemicals present in the beds and sleep mats that newborn babies and young children rest their heads have the potential to alter their health for the rest of their life, totally negating the intentional choices that their mothers made on the path of lifelong health and wellness before they were born. As a parent, I've recently attempted to purchase a mattress for my son without flame retardants in Anchorage stores, but after calling furniture and mattress stores across town, I was informed time and time again that there were no options for flame retardant-free mattresses in the city. I was faced with the option of buying a mattress full of chemicals that are known to cause deleterious health effects to children, or to have him spend his 12 hours of sleep at night on a much safer homemade alternative. I'm sure the Anchorage stores were sad to lose the business of another informed mother protecting her children from being exposed to known harmful chemicals for half of his day. The chemicals in question not only have been proven to have carcinogenic properties as well as other harmful effects, but they also have not been shown to have a reasonable benefit in reducing mortality or morbidity from fire. In addition, these chemicals have already been banned from children's clothing for the very reasons I have previously listed. I urge you to protect Alaskan children from the unnecessary exposure to harmful chemicals in order to maintain the health of their mothers, strive so hard to give them, and for the protection of the economic, social, and physical wellness of all Alaskans. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jessica. Next up, and please try to keep it to 2 minutes. We have about 20 people to go through. Pamela Miller, please.
I would like to begin by thanking Chair Stedman and members of the committee for the opportunity to provide testimony today on Senate Bill 151. My name is Pamela Miller. I'm Executive Director with Alaska Community Action on Toxics, a statewide environmental health organization of scientists, public health professionals, and community advocates. We strongly support Senate Bill 151 because it is an important measure to protect public health and especially the health of our most vulnerable babies, infants, and children, as well as firefighters who are on the front lines of exposure to these dangerous chemicals. This year, at least 33 states are stepping up to protect public health and considering policies addressing the untested toxic chemicals in everyday products. Toys, clothes, bedding, baby shampoo, all of these contain chemicals that are toxic to the brain and to the body. We've known for years that the federal law meant to protect us, the Toxic Substances Control Act of 1976, is outdated, and it allows untested chemicals and known carcinogens, hormone disruptors, and other toxics into the products we use every day. Although Congress has failed to fix the law, states have established over 200 policies in the last 10 years to protect people from the hazardous chemicals in consumer products. We're very grateful to Senator Olson for introducing Senate Bill 151 and strongly support it because it gives the state of Alaska the opportunity to better protect the health of children by establishing a list of chemicals of high concern for children. This provides parents, healthcare professionals, and policymakers important information to make enlightened decisions about chemicals and products that may cause harm. The latest science shows that exposure to industrial chemicals that are used in everyday products is silently eroding intelligence, disrupting learning and behavior, truncating future achievements, and damaging society and future generations. These developmental neurotoxic chemicals can cause permanent brain injury when young children are exposed. And these include well-known ones such as lead, mercury, certain pesticides, PCBs, as well as flame retardant chemicals, PBDEs, and also the TRIS chemicals that are dealt with in this bill. I think the evidence is clear and compelling that chlorinated TRIS compounds now used as replacement chemicals in children's furniture, nap mats, nursing pads, crib mattresses, and play tunnels are carcinogenic and mutagenic. And the previous testifier provided information to that effect, so I won't go over that, but I'll send in my testimony. Studies also show that the addition of these flame retardant chemicals to furniture products does not provide proven fire safety benefits, although they do make the product much more hazardous while in use and more toxic if they do catch fire due to the release of highly toxic dioxins and furans.
Pamela, could I get you to finish up, please?
Yes, sir. We just respectfully urge you to pass this crucial public health measure. You are hearing from healthcare providers, firefighters, native leaders, and parents. Thank you for considering my testimony today.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, we're going to go to Fairbanks LIO. Kyle Green, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kyle Green. I'm representing the Fairbanks Firefighters Association. As a firefighter with duties for fire code enforcement, fire investigation, and public fire and life safety education. In regards to Senate Bill 151. We fully support this bill because not only are we protecting Alaska's children and families, but this bill will help protect Alaska firefighters and their families as well. As mentioned by the previous testimony, the toxins that are put off in smoke from these chemicals are very harmful to firefighters. While we've taken steps as a firefighting community to mitigate these hazards to us, that includes personal protective equipment like SCBAs and personal protective clothing like our bunker gear, there have been additional studies on our side of the arena where they have shown that they have found these chemicals that are in smoke appearing on firefighters' skin as well in the absorption through their skin. And so this, as a firefighter community, we have realized that now not only do we face hazards on the fire scene with burns, building collapse, but we also have this unseen danger that we are trying to protect ourselves against with exposure to chemicals in the atmospheric conditions that we encounter. The cancer rate for firefighters has grown significantly over the past several years and has spurred more action and protection for us. You know, in regards to the use of these flame retardants in materials in our homes, if they were as effective, we should see a better decline in the rate of fires. However, there are better ways and much more safer ways to provide for the safety of not only the public but firefighters, which to include is educating the public about how to prevent fires, and the implementation of residential fire sprinklers and suppressing fires before they get too big and before they produce all these toxins to begin with. Those are much safer ways than trying to mitigate the fire hazard through toxic chemicals such as these trees flame retardants and other untested chemicals. Thank you for your time, and again, we support the Senate Bill 151.
Yeah, thank you for your testimony, Kyle. Next up, Patricia Lee.
Good afternoon. Patrice Lee, Fairbanks, representing myself. I stand in full support of Senate Bill 151, the Toxic Free Children's Act. An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Children should not be exposed to known toxic chemicals. We have high levels of cancer, neurological disorders, etc. in Alaska, and we should do everything we can to prevent exposures to toxics. I believe that industry should have to prove that the materials they use in products are safe before they are allowed to use them. Presently, it is often not the case. It's the other way around. Citizens and consumers must try to prove or show that substances are harmful, often without the benefit of the resources to do so. We need the state to step up and take this rare opportunity to make it a real change for the better. In other modern countries, toxics are not allowed in children's products. It's no wonder their rates of illness and disorders are often less than ours. With Senate Bill 151, we have the opportunity to do it right, to be on the right side of history to protect Alaska's children from needless exposure to harmful chemicals. Healthier children mean less expensive health care and a brighter future for our most precious asset, our children. Please pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Patrice. Next, we're going to go to the off-net. And again, identify yourself for the record, who you represent, and speak to the bill. We'll start with Joel Kraft, please.
Yes, good afternoon. Joel Kraft with Quirk Incorporated here in Nome. Thank you, Senator Stedman and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee, for the opportunity to provide testimony in support of Senate Bill 151, an act relating to chemicals of high concern for our children. I am testifying as a father and a service provider for children's programs on behalf of Quirk Incorporated, the regional nonprofit corporation that services for the 20 tribal governments within our Bering Strait region. We support Senate Bill 151 because it includes important measures to protect children's health by requiring a listing of chemicals of high concern for children and phasing out harmful TRIS chemicals in children's products that are known to be cancer-causing and associated with impairment of neurodevelopment, endocrine disruption, and reproductive disorders. We must do everything we can to protect the health of our children and their capacity to learn and grow in a healthy environment. Our developing children are the most vulnerable to the effects of exposure to these harmful chemicals that are unnecessarily added to household products. TRIS chemicals are known to be highly hazardous to children and do not provide proven fire safety benefits. In October 2013, the Alaska Federation of Natives passed a resolution supporting chemicals policy reform at the state level, calling on legislators to pass legislation that would phase out persistent bioaccumulative chemicals and/or those linked to birth defects, cancer, genetic harm, endocrine disorders, immune and neurologic damage, and use safer alternatives. Senate Bill 151 is an important step in the right direction towards protecting the health of our present and future generations. We are concerned about the high rate of birth defects among our Alaska Native infants. As you know, we have the highest rate of birth defects in the nation, and Alaska Native infants have twice the risk of birth defects as white infants born in our state. We are also concerned about protecting children from exposure to known cancer-causing chemicals because we see too many cancers in our communities. These harmful chemicals, TRIS flame retardants, are known to interfere with learning and development. We cannot allow our children to be exposed to chemicals that affect their intellectual ability and their capacity to learn their culture, language, and advance their education. We request that you pass Senate Bill 151 expeditiously to support the health and well-being of our children and families. We thank Senator Olson for introducing and sponsoring this bill, and know that as a physician from our region, he understands the health concerns of our people and the urgent need for measures to protect our children. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Joel. Next, we're going to go to Anchorage. Brian Parch.
Hey, Mr. Chair. My name is Brian Parch. I'm with the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association, and I'll cut my testimony down a little bit here just because a lot of the points have already been covered by the other speakers on support of this. I'm going to be speaking on support of Senate Bill 151 and Alaska's firefighters. We now have a higher risk of cancer due to exposure of burning and smoldering items containing such chemicals as the TRIS flame retardants. We believe that a ban on TRIS flame retardants is a step in the right direction and following a trend with other states across the U.S. with protecting the health and safety of our members and the people that we serve. So SB 151 will protect the consumer and the firefighters of Alaska by removing yet another toxic cancer-causing chemical from the smoke and gases given off during a fire. Proven measures that are properly used, such as smoke alarms, sprinkler systems, building codes, and fire education, are far more effective and have less of effect on our firefighters that absorb these chemicals into their bodies through their skin and other means. Another big aspect of this, too, is our fire investigators who spend prolonged periods of time within these buildings trying to investigate the cause and origin of these fires. they're exposed to these chemicals even further than the firefighters that are actually fighting the fires themselves. So just real quick, in conclusion, I'd just like to state that the Alaska Professional Firefighters Association support fire safety measures that do not cause harm to firefighters or consumers. Therefore, we encourage the committee members to pass Senate Bill 151. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Brian. Next, we're going to jump to North Pole. Jeff Tucker, please.
Yes, hello, Mr. Chairman. My name is Jeff Tucker. I'm the fire chief for the North Star Fire Department, and I'm also second vice president of the Alaska Fire Chiefs Association. I'm here to speak on behalf of Senate Bill 151 and urge your support. I've already provided a letter of support to the committee, and I echo the comments of the other fire professionals who have already testified in support of Senate Bill 151, and I'll keep my comments very short and to the point. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony today. Next, we're going to go to Savunga. Tiffany Immingen.
Hello. It's Immingen, sir. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, members of the Health and Social Service Committee. My name is Tiffany Immingen. My epic name is Akai. I'm a Siberian-Inupiaq youth from St. Lawrence Island, Alaska, located in the northern Bering Sea. I was raised in the community of Savunga. I'm here to speak in support of Senate Bill 151. As a volunteer with ACAT of Alaska Community Action on Toxics, I travel and testify and fight to push for safer chemical laws to protect communities like mine and future generations. I care about toxic chemicals because they have an impact on my island and in my community. On St. Lawrence Island, there was an estimate of 1,400 people in two communities, Gamble and Savunga. There was one year where we had 19 deaths from cancers and illnesses. I care about toxic chemicals because I love my traditional food, my island, and my culture. Unfortunately, there are chemicals such as PCBs present on the island and in the traditional foods that we rely on. We should protect our children because it is a must. Our children are our future. Not only are they our future, they are little babies who are developing and growing. They simply cannot handle exposure to all these chemicals, all these toxic chemicals, which are foreign to anybody. If this present trend of leaving a toxic legacy to our children continues, what will our future look like? Senate Bill 151 is good because it actually would protect our children from some of the worst chemicals, including Trish flame retardants that are found in children products. People need this information to be available so that we can better protect ourselves and future generations. I want to thank Senator Olson, Senator of my region, for introducing this bill to protect Alaska children from toxics. For these reasons, I urge you to pass Senate Bill 151. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Tiffany, for your testimony. Next, we're going to go to the outside, Sacramento, Tim Shastek.
Hi, good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tim Shestick. I work for the American Chemistry Council. We have submitted some written comments and other background materials detailing our position on this bill as drafted. In the interest of time, I'd like to just highlight a couple of major points that summarize our concerns with the bill as drafted. First, the bill requires the creation of a list of chemicals that may be used in certain consumer products, but is silent on how that information might be used or how the information might be communicated to the public, retailers, or others. Assessing the safety of a chemical compound requires looking both at the potential hazard of a given chemical as well as any potential exposure. And in the mere presence of a chemical in a product does not necessarily mean that the product is harmful or that the product or the use of that chemical in that product is a violation of any existing safety standards or law. And so we're concerned that the bill would simply result in a list of chemicals present in products without any corresponding information for the public as to what that information means, or perhaps more importantly, what it doesn't mean. Compiling a list of chemicals is certainly not the same as conducting a scientific evaluation of how those chemicals are used, in what amounts, and whether their use poses any sort of unreasonable risk. The final point I'd like to make is that when the sponsor's opening comments alluded to an effort, a congressional effort, to update the Federal Toxic Substance Control Act The Chemical Safety Improvement Act is a bill that is currently pending in Congress. We certainly recognize the need to modernize the federal chemical regulatory system so that consumers and others can have greater confidence in the safety of consumer products. The Chemical Safety Improvement Act is currently being supported by over 100 business groups, organized labor. Both U.S. senators from your state and Alaska are co-sponsors of the bill. It would certainly and significantly change the way chemicals are regulated in this country, further providing U.S. EPA with authority to conduct safety assessments on chemicals based solely on consideration of risk to human health and the environment, and certainly gives U.S. EPA the ability to focus in on sensitive subpopulations, such as children, when they're doing these safety assessments. We frankly feel that the Chemical Safety Improvement Act that's pending in Congress really strikes the right balance in establishing a predictable and workable regulatory environment for U.S. manufacturing as well as U.S. retailers. And so we believe that's the better approach, and we would encourage you to currently oppose SB 151 as it's drafted. Appreciate the opportunity to make these comments.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Next up, from the outside, Thomas Osmitz. Thomas Osmitz.
This is Tom Osmitz. Am I on it?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity to testify at this hearing today. By way of background, I have a doctorate degree in toxicology and certified in toxicology by the American Board of Toxicology and also the European Registry of Toxicologists. And for those of you not familiar with toxicology, it's really the study of the adverse effects of chemicals and biological agents on people, animals, the environments, and we're trained to interpret and explain those data not only to the public but to other scientific people and medical people who have to deal with regulations and other aspects of chemical management. I spent over 30 years as a toxicologist in various capacities examining a wide range of chemicals primarily used in products that consumers, including children, come in contact with. And I'm here to speak on behalf of the American Chemistry Council, specifically with regard to the proposed prohibition of specific flame-retardant chemicals. And the issue of TCPP, one of the three chemicals, is illustrative of the problem in this approach. It's very complicated, the nomenclature TCPP, TCEP. It's very confusing, and often people, as we're doing here, lump them all together as TRIS chemicals. That's really too simple a solution because there's many differences between these chemicals. TCPP, for example, has been extremely well studied in contrast to what some people may believe or may say. It's been through worldwide safety approvals. Most recently, the European Union did a 400-page assessment of risks associated with TCPP. It's a document that I consider to be the most comprehensive and carefully done assessment for TCPP. A careful risk assessment looking at consumer exposures to TCP and a variety of uses, and they saw no reasons for further restrictions of use. Now, I might point out that TCPP, the primary use of it is in foam insulation, used to meet building codes and increase energy efficiency. There may be some products which, through Chinese suppliers, may have small amounts of it in, but the American industry does not use TCPP in any of the kinds of uses being discussed here today. The bill proposes a criteria and a process by which these chemicals can be identified. It's important to note that from the standpoint of TCPP, it's not persistent, bioaccumulative, and toxic. It's not a carcinogen, reproductive toxicant, developmental toxicant, or an endocrine disruptor, so it would not have the properties listed in the bill as defining chemicals of high concern. So in closing, we respectfully request that any reference to flame retardants such as TCPP be removed from the bill. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you today.
Okay, and Thomas, just for the record, could you please re-identify yourself and who you represent?
Sure. Thomas Osimitz, O-S-I-M-I-T-Z.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thanks so much.
We're going to now come into the room. Susan Walsh, please.
Good afternoon, and thank you very much, Senator Stedman and Vice Chair Senator Michiki and members of the Senate Health and Social Services Committee for this opportunity to speak. It's after lunch, and everybody's blood sugars are dropping, and it's hard to stay awake with all the chemical talk here as far as...
Susan, before you start, yes. Could you tell us who you are and
yes,
who you represent?
Yes, I will. I was going into that. I am... My name is Susan Walsh, and I've had the privilege and honor to serve the community of Ketchikan for the last 36 years as a labor and delivery nurse and certified pediatric nurse. And I've had the opportunity to assist in the delivery of hundreds of babies and teach childbirth education classes. I am also a recent past president and current board member of the Alaska Nurses Association. I have provided written testimony in your packets. I believe everybody has that. So I won't beleaguer the point. I do support the past speakers that have supported Senate Bill 151. And I have also had the privilege to go to D.C. and talk about the Reform Act of the TSCA 1976 bill. I was asked in Washington, D.C., what's the cost of this legislation? And here we were given a fiscal note, too, of about $400,000 altogether. And I want to ask you guys what the cost of not implementing this bill is, because we have seen a significant rise in autism, birth defects, and handicaps, learning disabilities, with the introduction of these chemicals. And you should not need a degree in chemistry to go ahead and identify what's in your product. And I can understand the chamber's anxiety as far as opposing this, but as one of the speakers said, they're losing businesses because as people get more and more informed of what the chemicals, the harmful effects that the chemicals might have on their children, they are going to be, you know, boycotting those businesses. So I think it's time for us to be waking up. And the Alaska Nurses Association in October passed a resolution calling for meaningful chemical policy reform on the state level that reduces the use of toxic chemicals and requires that less harmful chemicals be substituted whenever possible and ensures adequate information on the health effect of chemicals is available to the public before these chemicals are introduced on the market. Senate Bill 151 is a critical bill for the protection of our children, firefighters, and other vulnerable populations. We urge, as the Nurses Association, passage of this reform.
Okay, thank you. And your timing was perfect. Mm-hmm.
Impeccable.
Next up. Bethany Ann? Probably have to help me with the, so I get your, when you introduce yourself, I'll have her down.
Thank you. Bethany Buchanan, okay. Family nurse, Dr. Bethany Buchanan, family nurse practitioner for 17 years in Anchorage, representing the Alaska Nurse Practitioner Association and the ANA. I'm going to take it just a smidgen differently and give you a little tiny endocrine lesson. The endocrine system is made up of glands and tissues that secrete hormones. Hormones are chemical messengers that will fill in a receptor site in a cell and turn it on and make something happen. Many known chemicals disrupt this process. Most of them are called xenoestrogens. Xeno means outside or foreign. So you've got these foreign estrogens coming in, disrupting feedback systems to the brain, the pituitary, ovaries, testes, scrotum, thyroid, adrenals. The glands are then getting altered information when they want to send and receive signals. And so what happens is that it's more or less accelerating unnatural sexual growth, and that can lead to precocious puberty in boys and girls. So you have girls starting to menstruate at age 9 instead of 12. You have boys who have undescended testes. You have boys with smaller penises and scrotums, which I know you don't want happening to your grandsons. You have infertility with lower sperm counts. You have infertility in women. More gynecological issues, there's known breast cancer, tissue growth, well, increased breast cancer in cultures going on in tissue cultures, and thyroid abnormalities, because estrogen and thyroid compete for the same binding sites, and so when you have xenoestrogens taking over those sites, you have less thyroid activity. So life relies on the biochemical transmission, and when those are disrupted, starting at an early age with chemical exposure, you have lifelong chronic problems. And I encourage you to think about that when you pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, we have a question here.
Any questions?
Senator Machiki.
So I know everything there is to know about those issues now that you've been up. But what I would like to know, is there a list of chemicals that we have where we've made a connection between the issues you discussed and the chemicals and products?
phthalates in plastic, bisphenol A in plastics, dioxins, DDT, lead. Those are some of the ones off the top of my head.
Mr. Chairman, do you have a written testimony?
I created this last night. Well, I can submit my written testimony if you'd like that.
Through the chair, if you could, to the chair or to myself. I mean, it was just very informative. I'd be interested if you... Sounds like you could probably whip it up pretty quick.
So. I have it typed up. I memorized it before I sat down, so I'd be happy to send it along.
Thank you. And then just send it to my office, and then we'll distribute it to the committee.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Susan Walsh?
No, it's me.
Oh, excuse me. Okay. Yeah, it is. Got you twice. I should have caught it. And the other three ladies, I noticed Mark didn't want to testify, but is there any remorse? Do they want to come up and testify?
No.
Okay, that's fine. That concludes our public hearing. We've gone through the off-net and the LIOs and in-room testimony. We have the bill sponsor with energy charge forward and present himself to the committee. Do we have any final questions for the bill sponsor before we set this bill aside? Seeing none. So this will conclude today's meeting. Our next meeting will be Friday, the 21st of February, 1:30 p.m. We'll have two bills on the agenda, Senate Bill 169 regarding a statewide immunization program, Senate Bill 162 regarding hydrocodone prescriptions by optometrists. And then we'll be working on our schedule for Thursday. We'll probably be busy next week, too. And we are adjourned.